Good morning. Republicans and Democrats want to capture the growing Latino vote. Coming up, we'll hear about the first president to court Latinos, JFK. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. The head of the World Food Program tells us about feeding the millions affected by the typhoon in the Philippines. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. We'll hear Renee's interview with WFP director Etherin Cousin. We also take an incredible walk in the desert. Paul Salopek is working his way from Africa across Asia to the Americas almost entirely on foot. Just now he's in the landscape of Lawrence of Arabia. And farmers insist on their right to use the most natural of all fertilizers. It's Thursday, November 21st, the birthday of Tina Brown, regular guest in this program. The news is next.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The Senate Banking Committee is scheduled to vote today on Janet Yellen's nomination to head the Federal Reserve. As NPR's John Itzde reports, it's virtually certain the committee will forward her nomination to the full Senate.
With Democrats holding a majority of seats on the committee, there's little doubt Yellen's nomination will go to the full Senate. And Tennessee Republican Bob Corker's announcement Wednesday that he'll support her nomination suggests Yellen's path to confirmation on the Senate floor could be easier. The 55 Democrats in the Senate need five Republicans to vote with them in order to overcome procedural hurdles some GOP senators have threatened to erect. A number of other Republicans suggest they will ultimately support Yellen, but officially remain undecided. Yellen would succeed Ben Bernanke and likely continue the policies of the current chairman, whose term expires at the end of January. John Itzde, NPR News, Washington.
Negotiators from six countries and Iran are struggling to work out an agreement over Iran's nuclear program. Diplomats at the Geneva talks are weighing whether to ease international sanctions on Iran in exchange for Tehran's curbing of uranium enrichment. Iran's Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi says both sides must remain flexible.
I think what we need is goodwill and a real willingness and determination to resolve these differences and to bridge these differences. I believe a solution is at our reach. What we need is only good faith.
Secretary of State John Kerry says he's prepared to join the talks if needed. Greece's international lenders say Athens has not yet met all the conditions for continuing to get financial aid from an international bailout package. As Terry Schultz reports from Brussels, the head of the Eurozone says European Union partners are losing patience.
The EU and the International Monetary Fund say their latest review of Greek reforms show Athens hasn't yet met the commitments it made for receiving two rescues worth hundreds of billions of dollars. A joint statement from the IMF and EU says good progress has been made, but a few issues remain outstanding and discussions will continue next month. Disputes remain particularly over how much money Greece needs to save in order to meet next year's targets. These audits, checking on financial reforms and restructuring, determine whether Greece gets the next chunk of its bailout cash. Eurozone Chief Jurin Dijsselbloem is quoted in a Greek newspaper as saying Athens has a lot of work left to do in improving its competitiveness and attracting foreign investment. For NPR News, I'm Terry Schultz in Brussels.
U.S. and Afghan leaders have tentatively reached a security deal that would let some U.S. troops stay in Afghanistan after 2014. The proposed pact is now before a huge meeting of Afghan elders known as the Loya Jirga. The 3,000 delegates will meet over the next few days. They can advise Afghan lawmakers to change or even reject the deal. You're listening to NPR News. Evangelist Billy Graham has been hospitalized in Asheville, North Carolina, with respiratory issues. His spokesman, Jeremy Bloom, says Graham was hospitalized earlier this month with the same issue.
As was the case then, we expect this to be a short day or two in the hospital, and he'll return home.
Billy Graham just celebrated his 95th birthday. New research published in the New England Journal of Medicine finds people who regularly eat nuts are more likely to live longer compared to those who eat nuts infrequently. As NPR's Allison Aubrey reports, researchers also found a reduced risk of death from heart disease and cancer among nut eaters.
There's a whole body of evidence linking nut consumption to lower risks of strokes, heart attacks, and type 2 diabetes. And now there's the finding that nuts are linked to longevity. Researchers at Harvard combined studies that included about 76,000 women and 42,000 men who completed food frequency surveys every 2 to 4 years over several decades. The participants answered all kinds of questions about what they ate, including how many servings of nuts. Researchers found that people who ate 7 or more small servings of nuts per week were about 20% less likely to die prematurely compared to those who never ate nuts. The research was funded by the National Institutes of Health, along with a grant from the nut industry. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
Gay and lesbian couples will soon be able to wed in Illinois. Governor Pat Quinn signed a bill yesterday permitting same-sex marriage. These will become legal next June. Illinois becomes the 16th state to permit the unions, along with Washington, D.C. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Walton Family Foundation, whose K-12 initiative works to empower families with quality school choices. WaltonK12.org.
Good morning. It's 8:06. I'm Jeff Bossert with Illinois Public Media News. Following this week's devastating tornado in the Champaign County town of Gifford, the county's emergency management agency says it will review the effectiveness of its warning system. Spokesman Rick Atterbury says early indications are that everything went well in terms of letting people know the storm was coming. Even though an EF3 tornado touched down in Gifford where emergency sirens went off, the agency didn't trigger sirens in nearby Champaign-Urbana, Savoy, and at the University of Illinois campus. Atterbury says that would have happened if his office felt the tornado was headed to those areas.
It's one of those darned if you do and darned if you don't situations. The concern is if you blow the sirens too often, people become kind of immune to them and don't respond to them anymore. It's the old crying wolf syndrome. On the other hand, you never want to be caught when you should have blown them and didn't. So it's a very delicate balancing act that we take in the county.
Power has been restored to all homes in Gifford where it's safe to do so. Atterbury says supplies are available for people in need of assistance. Meanwhile, 15 Illinois counties have now been declared state disaster areas after strong weekend storms. Governor Pat Quinn Wednesday added Vermilion County and Fayette County to the list, getting extra state aid. Sunday storms spawned more than a dozen tornadoes that killed at least 6 people and destroyed hundreds of homes and businesses. Illinois is now the 16th state to legalize same-sex marriage. Governor Quinn signed the bill into law at a festive ceremony yesterday at the University of Illinois, Chicago. Alex Keefe has more.
The UIC Forum was packed with more than 2,000 people, many waving little rainbow flags, each bearing the silhouette of the state of Illinois. The Chicago Gay Men's Chorus warmed up the crowd with an a cappella rendition of America the Beautiful.
America, God shed his grace on you.
Democratic Governor Pat Quinn got a standing ovation before making his remarks, where he quoted from Corinthians.
Love endures all things. Love never fails. And I'm going to sign this bill right now.
Quinn then sat down at a wooden desk draped with red, white, and blue bunting, a desk once used by Abraham Lincoln, and signed the bill as Illinois' most powerful politicians looked on. County clerks in Illinois can begin issuing the first marriage licenses to gay couples starting June 1st. From the UIC Forum, I'm Alex Keefe.
Meanwhile, a group of Catholics met in Springfield yesterday to hold prayers of exorcism. They were atoning for what they see as the sin that is Illinois' new definition of marriage. Brian Mackey has that story.
Springfield Bishop Thomas Paprocki led at least 200 people through prayers of supplication and exorcism. While the word exorcism conjures up images from the movies, the reality was far more somber. Speaking in Latin, he began, "Exorcizo te, omnis immune spiritus." I exorcise you, every unclean spirit. Paprocki acknowledges the church might be out of step with the trend in society, but he points out the Catholic Church has its roots 2,000 years ago in the Roman Empire and had to wait centuries before it could work with governments.
So for the church to be countercultural is not necessarily anything new for us.
Paprocki says this was a minor exorcism of the kind found in the routine language of the Catholic baptism ceremony. He says in this case, it's not that people are possessed by the devil, but a more subtle, diabolical influence on our society. I'm Brian Mackey.
In sports, Manhattan down Illinois State in basketball 79-70. There's more news online at will.illinois.edu. Occasional rain in Champaign-Urbana today. Isolated thunderstorms this afternoon, the high around 50 degrees, winds up to 15 miles an hour. Rain expected this evening as well, the low 42 degrees. Cloudy skies tomorrow with a 30% chance of showers, the high 45 degrees, winds up to 25 miles an hour. Lows coming Saturday around 15 degrees, 47 in Danville and Decatur, 46 on Friends Plaza. I'm Jeff Bossert, Illinois Public Media News. It's 10 past 8.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. We're about to hear the little-known backstory to one of the major political trends of our time. The trend is the growing power of the Latino vote.
Democrats won big among Latinos in recent presidential elections. Many Republicans think their future depends on doing better among Latinos.
It's no accident that potential Republican candidates for 2016 include two men with Hispanic last names and a third who's fluent in Spanish. Now for the backstory. We can trace back the effort to court the national Hispanic vote a half century. On what turned out to be the last night of his life, President John F. Kennedy attended a Hispanic event in Texas. NPR's Karen Grigsby Bates has the story.
On the night of November 21, 1963, President John F. Kennedy stopped briefly at a formal dinner in Houston held by LULAC, the League of United Latin American Citizens, which made him the first sitting president to attend a Hispanic event. A mariachi band played the beloved folk song Celito Lindo, and a radiant Jacqueline Kennedy addressed the crowd in her boarding school Spanish. It was reminiscent of her 1960 televised campaign commercial that had charmed Spanish speakers nationwide.
Queridos amigos, les habla la esposa del senador John F. Kennedy, candidato a la presidencia de los Estados Unidos.
The First Lady's ability to speak Spanish was widely appreciated, and it didn't hurt that the Kennedys were Roman Catholic, like most Mexican-American families. Her remarks at the LULAC dinner were met with applause and shouts of Viva Kennedy and Viva Jackie. For the jubilant Mexican-American audience, it was a long-awaited sign of respect. Ignacio Garcia is a history professor at Brigham Young University and the author of Viva Kennedy, Mexican-Americans in Search of Camelot. He says Mexican-American veterans were the driving force behind John Kennedy's political support. They'd returned from the war with expectations.
They assumed that things would change, just that they would be like they were in the foxhole or in the military unit. And when they came back and found that things had not changed, they became very much adamant about changing things.
To effect change, Professor Garcia says, Mexican-American vets became social activists and eventually the backbone of Hispanic political organization in Texas. The American GI Forum was started by Dr. Hector P. Garcia, a surgeon and former Army major who worked to get Hispanic vets equal benefits. The forums operated in Texas and several other states and became the foundation for Viva Kennedy clubs, which supported the senator from Boston. Ted Kennedy was the designated liaison to the Mexican-American community and developed warm relationships that continued until his death. Here's a ballad or corrido lauding him as the Lion of the Senate.
Edward Kennedy era un hombre querido y muy respetado.
The Viva Kennedy clubs operated independently of the Democratic Party. Members fundraised and held events with no oversight or interference. They even had their own logo. John Kennedy astride a burro, a nod to the Democrat symbol, wearing a sombrero emblazoned with Viva Kennedy across the front. It's now a collector's item. Dr. Hector Garcia's daughter, Wanda, recalls how drawn people were to the young candidate at rallies, including her very reserved mother.
Here's my mother, a dignified woman, jumping up and down, and I just looked at her like, Mama.
But 3 years into Kennedy's presidency, the hope Hispanic voters had had for high visibility representation had faded. Wanda Garcia remembers how her father irritated Attorney General Bobby Kennedy by pushing him hard to do more for Hispanics.
I can remember hearing many conversations between Bobby and my dad about this issue.
Part of the purpose behind Kennedy's swing through Texas in November 1963 was to show he was ready to re-earn Hispanic voters' support. Max Krochmal, a historian at Texas Christian University, says the Viva Kennedy clubs were a political watershed because they showed politicians and Mexican Americans the power of their vote.
The Viva Kennedy campaign really produced a measure of unity among Mexican Americans that was rarely seen before or after.
Several hours after attending the LULAC dinner in Houston, John Kennedy would be assassinated in Dallas. But the Viva Kennedy clubs and that night's event cemented a relationship between Democrats and many Mexican Americans that continues today. Karen Grigsby Bates, NPR News.
Now let's find some lessons in a modern-day political nightmare. It's the rollout of healthcare.gov, a website vital to the new health insurance law. President Obama says that after the mess of that website is fixed, it may be time for the government to learn better ways to buy information technology, or IT. The problem may boost a formerly obscure bill in Congress, as NPR's Elise Hugh reports.
As federal tech launches go, it's not just healthcare.gov that didn't take off. A report from IT research firm The Standish Group finds that 94% of federal IT projects either come in late, over budget, or get scrapped completely. A stat Congressman Daryl Issa is familiar with.
Well, federal IT has always been behind, but federal IT has also spent the money to not be behind. So you can't blame it on a lack of money.
Issa is the California Republican who chairs the House Committee investigating healthcare.gov. He's also the co-author of the Federal Information Technology Acquisition Reform Act. It's called FITARA for short. One reason it's important is because the federal government spent $82 billion taxpayer dollars last year on technology projects with mixed results.
Everyone wants something that does well and costs the American people less. And the $82 billion we spend on IT is not well spent today, and it's a management organizational problem.
To address the management problem, FITARA puts the role of Chief Information Officer, or CIO, at the heart of federal agencies, giving them more budget authority, power, and prominence.
And you prevent the proliferation of CIOs in name only. You begin to at least have a point at which somebody knows that if they're called on the carpet for a failure, they will own that failure.
ISA says more accountability attracts stronger candidates for those jobs, and stronger CIOs could mean better written contracts that make it harder to get away with doing bad work. In pushing this bill, ISA has healthcare.gov as an example of what went wrong and a dedicated partner.
Every day's a holiday.
FITARA's co-author is Virginia Representative Jerry Connolly, a Democrat.
It is unusual.
On almost every other issue, Connolly not only disagrees with, but quite publicly opposes ISA.
I will admit it probably raised some eyebrows here in town that ISA and Connolly got together on anything. But on this one, we both feel passionate.
Connolly says his Northern Virginia district is notable for being home to more federal IT contractors than any others. So FITARA is a priority for his constituents. And besides strengthening CIOs, the bill clarifies current law that allows for open source or more transparent software solutions. He hopes that makes it more appealing for smaller companies to bid on projects.
We haven't updated federal IT acquisition and procurement rules in a quarter of a century. Now, in the world of IT, fast-moving IT, that is, you know, that's a millennium. So it's about time, it's long overdue, that we reform the system and try to make it more responsive, more accountable, more effective.
After all, the internet was first created inside the federal government, so it can do innovation. Right now, the next move on FITARA is up to the Senate. The House already passed it in June without much notice. In light of healthcare.gov, ISA's hoping it gets through both chambers.
These are not partisan issues.
Connolly thinks it could happen.
I think it's probably the best bill we're going to get out of this Congress. It would be a terrible missed opportunity if the Senate doesn't act on this bill.
A fairly broad, bipartisan bill out of this Congress sounds like a lofty goal, but the unexpected does happen. There's the pairing up of the bill's two co-authors as a good example. Elise Hugh, NPR News, Washington.
And you hear her right here on Morning Edition from NPR News.
On the next Focus, President Tom Ramage of Parkland College in Champaign and President Alice Jacobs of Danville Area Community College will talk about how community colleges are moving forward despite cuts in state funding and changes in local tax support. We'll hear about Danville's veterans training program and Parkland's acquisition of the U of I's aviation program. I'm Jim Meadows. That's Focus Thursday morning at 10 on AM 580.
It's 8:19. You're listening to Morning Edition on WILL. I'm Jeff Bossert. In 15 minutes, Illinois Public Radio's Chip Mitchell looks at some of the obstacles that unauthorized immigrants face when trying to take advantage of a new law, letting them obtain driver's licenses. One Chicago area sheriff says the state is taking too much time with the rollout of that measure. In Champaign-Urbana today, we're expecting occasional rain. It's overcast this morning, isolated thunderstorms in the forecast this afternoon. The high around 50 degrees, winds up to 15 miles an hour. Periods of rain this evening with a low of 42 degrees and an 80% chance of showers. Cloudy skies tomorrow, 30% chance of showers, a high of 45, wind gusts up to 25 miles an hour. Friday evening, colder and mostly cloudy with a low of 25. Blustery on Saturday, sunny skies, otherwise the high 35. Mostly clear Saturday evening with a low of 15 degrees. 47 in Danville and Decatur. It's 46 on Friends Plaza.
Support for today's broadcast comes from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods, with foods from around the world, including imported chocolates, truffles, cookies, cheeses, and gift baskets for the holidays. Also, find specialty ingredients like saffron, smoked paprika, truffle salt, grain of paradise, and more. World Harvest Foods, 6th and University in Champaign.
Let's check in again with Paul Salopek, the man who's walking across four continents. We've been talking from time to time with this National Geographic writer who was following the ancient path of human migration from Africa across Asia to the Americas, all on foot, and along the way writing stories or recording diary entries like this one he recorded near Djibouti in East Africa.
A wind blows through the dune palm fronds. If you listen hard enough, it sounds almost like rain. It hasn't rained here, though, for a year.
After recording that, Paul Salopek caught a boat carrying camels and sheep across the Red Sea, and we find him now. Well, Paul, where are you?
I just crossed the border into Jordan from Saudi Arabia. The Arabian Peninsula has taken me about 7 months.
Going through what kind of landscape? We say desert and we imagine sand, we imagine dunes, but what's it like as you're traveling on foot?
It's been mainly through a region of Saudi Arabia called the Hejaz, which is the northwestern segment of that country. Sand dunes indeed, lots of sand, but also a coastline, because I've been hugging the Red Sea coast as I move north. So a very stark landscape of white land meeting ink blue waters.
Paul, when you say the Hejaz, the reason that phrase is familiar to me is because of books about Lawrence of Arabia. Is that the very landscape you're working through?
It is indeed. It's kind of a fabled corner of the world. And as far as I can tell, I might be the first outsider to actually walk along this coastline through this arena of war and the sacred landscape in many, many years, possibly since the Arab revolt itself in 1918.
What's it like to walk for months through the desert?
It stretches your sense of time. It stretches your sense of space. I mean, it's been a spatial adjustment, going from travel times that we measure in hours, say in a car, to thinking that walking for 10 days to the next town is quite normal.
You know, I'm thinking about the fact that you're trying to do 20 miles a day, but also that in the desert, if you're on a relatively high place, you may have a view of many, many miles. Have there been days when you've woken up and looked out across the desert, and by the end of the day, you haven't even made it out of that original field of view? You haven't even made it to the original morning's horizon?
The sense of distance is really distorted in this minimal landscape. It is like being on a gigantic stage. And there have absolutely been times when I've thought I'm walking to a little clump of thorn trees, maybe a mile away, to take a little shade, when in fact it turns out to be a shrub that's only 200 yards away, that's 1 foot high. The sense of depth perception really changes and gets distorted when you have no scale to measure anything by.
Paul Salopek, would you remind people why on earth you're doing this?
Yeah, it's basically it's a project about storytelling. What I'm hoping to do is draw on my past experience as an international correspondent to string together all the stories that I've encountered and new ones into one long narrative storyline. And by connecting the past to contemporary events, I hope that my reporting has a little more depth and has some context, not just like at a national level, but through time, through deep history.
Well, having done a good chunk of Africa and now having begun the vastness of Asia, do you feel like you're learning anything about that?
You know, I am. I'm learning, of course, about individual stories that I would never have encountered when I was back being an industrial foreign correspondent, as it were, using cars or airplanes. And interesting connections, too. What's wonderful is they're unexpected. One example is the issue of women driving in Saudi, a perennial social justice issue, a concern of human rights activists in the West for many, many years.
Mm-hmm.
But what I didn't realize is that there are actually thousands of women who are driving in Saudi Arabia, but they all happen to be deep in the desert with these vestigial pastoral communities because they're driving out of necessity. And I saw them driving pickup trucks, hauling alfalfa for their camels. They're like women truckers in Texas.
Any of them pull over and ask you if you needed a ride?
On the contrary, one of them pulled a knife and basically was careful to keep me away from her daughter who was driving. Strange men appearing with camels, especially somebody who looks as strange as I do, probably frightened her.
Can I just mention, Paul Salopek, that you are now heading into a war-torn part of the world. Jordan, the country where you now are, has of course received refugees from and is on the border of both Syria and Iraq. How do you think that's going to affect your next steps?
In a very concrete way. When I began planning this journey almost 2 years ago, Syria was still at peace, and I've had every intention of walking through Syria. Now it effectively blocks my way. Iraq also, the news out of there is very bad. So I'm facing the conundrum of what to do next. But if I come up against human-made obstacles, conflict zones, regions of turmoil, I'm going to have to decide in real time how to get around them, very much in the way that our ancestors had to when they were moving across the surface of the earth, you know, 60,000 years ago, when they ran into glaciers, when they ran into big bodies of water or climatic barriers.
What does it do to your body to walk for 20 miles a day, day after day after day after day? How does it change you?
I think on a psychic level, it really builds confidence in your body. By and large, after 10 months of walking, it's about the most natural thing in the world to get up at dawn, have a cup of chai, have whatever's available to eat in the saddlebags, generally some local food, and then plot a course to the next well 20 to 25 miles away. There's something, Steve, about moving across the surface of the earth at 3 miles an hour, that feels really good. It feels normal. And the landscape kind of sliding by your shoulders as you turn your head left and right, there must be something limbic about it. It must not even be cerebral. It's in our backbones. It just feels like the right pace to be absorbing a landscape and information. So it's been a joy most days.
How's your family handling your time away?
So far, it's been okay, even though I'm using the trip to hearken back to this primeval movement of humans across the earth. I have the great advantage of modern technology, which I'm fully using. So I keep in touch on a daily basis with my family by satellite phone.
And they haven't declared you crazy yet and told you to come home?
Oh, they declared me crazy a long time ago. Yes.
But they're sticking with you.
My wife knew who she was marrying.
Paul Salopek's walk is the cover story of the December issue of National Geographic magazine. He's a National Geographic fellow. Thanks very much for talking with us once again.
Steve, it's great to chat again. Thanks for having me on.
Photos of Paul Salopek's journey are at npr.org. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations. And from CSX, whose trains can move a ton of freight nearly 450 miles on 1 gallon of fuel. CSX, how tomorrow moves. From Cancer Treatment Centers of America, with a diagnostic exam and treatment plan for advanced stage patients seeking a second opinion at cancercenter.com. And from Zurich Insurance, providing risk management and insurance solutions to help businesses meet their ever-changing needs. Learn more at zurichna.com. This is NPR.
Support comes from the Auto Mall of Champaign on Moreland Drive, a new car alternative offering hundreds of late model vehicles, including luxury sedans, family minivans, and SUVs. A listing of cars and trucks available is on the web at automallofcu.com. The Auto Mall invites you to join them in supporting WILL.
It's Morning Edition on WILL. I'm Jeff Bossert at 8:30. In 10 minutes, there's a greater meaning to this weekend's high school football playoff game between Washington, Illinois, and Springfield-based Sacred Heart Griffin. Illinois Public Radio's Charlie Schlenker reports on the resolve of players after a tornado ripped through Washington last weekend. In the forecast, occasional rain today, isolated thunderstorms, the high around 50 degrees. The low tonight, 42 degrees. Right now, 47 in Danville and Decatur, 46 on Friends Plaza.
Support for NPR comes from the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, helping people build measurably better lives. On the web at hewlett.org.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Jean Cochran. There's been a bit of strengthening in the labor market. New figures from the Labor Department show that claims for unemployment benefits were down last week by more than expected, 21,000. Also, inflation at the wholesale level is remaining tame, with producer prices dropping by 0.2% in October, led down again by cheaper gasoline prices. Economist Mark Zandi is with Moody's Analytics.
There is no inflation, very dormant. Prices are falling in large part because of lower energy prices, but even underlying core inflation, abstracting from energy and food prices, is very low and shows no signs of picking up.
And there's word this morning the federal government expects to sell its remaining stock in General Motors by the end of the year. It still owns more than 31 million shares after bailing out the automaker 5 years ago. The government has so far recovered more than $31 billion of the nearly $50 billion it sank into the company. Economist Janet Yellen's nomination to head the Federal Reserve is expected to take a big step toward confirmation with a vote today in the Senate Banking Committee. NPR's Craig Windham reports one of her more vocal critics has dropped his opposition.
Republican Senator Bob Corker voted against Yellen when she was nominated for her current post as vice chair of the Fed. He told CNBC last month that not much has changed since then.
I've seen nothing to change my view of where she is relative to monetary policy in the last 2 or 3 years.
Corker does not like the Fed's bond buying program to hold down interest rates, so he says he would prefer someone with more modest views on the limits of monetary policy. But Corker says Yellen is qualified to head the central bank. His support could persuade other Republicans to drop their opposition to Yellen, who is expected to be confirmed by the full Senate. Craig Windham, NPR News, Washington.
The president of Afghanistan, Hamid Karzai, has been making a pitch to tribal elders today, asking them to support the new security agreement with the United States. In a bit of an about-face, though, he has suggested he hold off signing the deal until after next year's presidential election. Six people are dead in a suspected U.S. drone strike in Pakistan. Here's NPR's Philip Reeves.
The missiles hit an Islamic seminary shortly before dawn. Pakistani officials say four of the dead are Afghan clerics from the so-called Haqqani Network. That's one of the militant groups battling American and Afghan government forces in Afghanistan. The seminary is in the Hangu district in northwest Pakistan, in an area with many Afghan refugees. Officials say there's been an angry response from residents who are blocking police from entering the attack site. American drone attacks in Pakistan are always widely condemned here as a violation of sovereignty. This strike especially sensitive, as it's against what Pakistanis call a settled area that's under government control.
This is NPR News.
I'm Jeff Bossert with Illinois Public Media News at 8:33. Attendees of a bill signing that will make Illinois the next state to allow same-sex marriage included several couples who hope to get married after the law takes effect in the summer. Amy Woolery from the Chicago suburb of Berwyn has been with her partner for 15 years. She attended the Wednesday event with the couple's two children. She says she and her partner didn't want a civil union when Illinois legalized them in 2011. They wanted to wait for marriage. The couple's 9-year-old daughter says she wants to be a flower girl in the wedding. And Jen Dickey Rothke has been with her partner for 13 years. They have a son together. They're planning a wedding for July. She says that getting married will signify that their family is equal. The signing of Illinois' same-sex marriage law by Governor Pat Quinn yesterday means couples in civil unions can alter their status when it takes effect next June. And for a year, a provision in the new law means the state will waive the fee involved with making that change. Nearly 200 civil unions have been recorded in Champaign County since that measure went into effect in 2011. Champaign County Clerk Gordy Holton says lots of those couples have asked about converting those relationships into a marriage.
We will then issue them a marriage certificate, basically modify their civil union record, convert it into a marriage, issue them a certified record of that marriage so that from that moment forward, they will then be married. And there's a one-year period in the new law where folks who are in a civil union can do that for no additional charge.
After June 1st, 2015, Holton says the cost of a marriage license for those same-sex couples who are in civil unions will be the same as it is for any other couple, $75. He also plans to accommodate gay couples wanting to get married on the earliest day possible. June 1st next year is a Sunday, but Holton says his office plans to be open that day for those who call in advance to get a marriage license. As the cleanup continues from the storm-ravaged community of Gifford, Champaign County Emergency Management Agency spokesman Rick Atterbury says Route 136 through the town is now open for traffic, but he says those looking to help, only skilled volunteers are sought today. Atterbury says no donations of clothes or auto items should be brought to the village. He said toiletries and other paper goods can be dropped off at the Eastern Illinois Food Bank in Urbana through 3 this afternoon. Atterbury says cash donations are needed the most right now.
It's just very difficult to manage material at this time. In fact, there were 3 locations in town where people were dropping off clothing and it just had to say no more. Getting the financial donations in can get that money in the hands of the people who need it that much more quickly.
Meanwhile, officials are set to meet in the Illinois community of Washington to conduct preliminary assessments of damage caused by a string of tornadoes. The information gatherer will be used by the state when it makes its request for federal disaster assistance. Federal officials will be in Gifford as well. Occasional showers today, isolated thunderstorms this afternoon, the high around 50 degrees, an 80% chance of showers. Rain expected tonight as well, the low 42 degrees, 47 in Danville and Decatur. It's 47 degrees right now on Friends Plaza. An Illinois law passed in last January that led up to 500,000 unauthorized immigrants drive legally for the first time. Many of them are having a hard time signing up for the license. And now a Chicago area sheriff says the state is rolling out the program too slowly. Chip Mitchell has more.
This stay-at-home mom on Chicago's southwest side says her days begin with driving her kids to school. And 3 times a week she drives her father to a clinic for dialysis. But every time she hits the road, she worries cops will pull her over. Like hundreds of thousands of Illinois residents who are in the country illegally, she doesn't have a driver's license. I'll call her Maria Lopez. She spoke on condition I not use her real name. She's got a cream-colored Ford Expedition, a big car. She let me ride shotgun the other day. Lopez wants one of the driver's licenses that Illinois is planning for immigrants like her. To get that license, Secretary of State Jesse White's office is requiring an appointment. Lopez signed up the first day she could. That was last week, and she thought she got a date. But the website seemed to crap out. Now she's not sure where she stands. Many other immigrants who want a license haven't gotten even that far. White's office acknowledges there could be 500,000 people eligible. But for at least a few more weeks, the Secretary of State's scheduling just 120 appointments a day.
I would expect this type of a pace if the law passed in Alabama, where we have a hostile immigrant tone. But in Illinois, there was overwhelming support for this legislation.
Lake County Sheriff Mark Curran says it's getting hard to promote the licenses among immigrants. He says they have a lot of fear and a lot of questions.
What if I go into this driver's license facility? Can they use whatever I say against me in a later process for citizenship? What if I've driven without a license before? What will happen to me? And so they have these concerns. And if they see these long delays when now is the time where they're looking at this, they may not ever avail themselves.
Riding with Lopez, she's that Chicago mom, I can't help but notice she obeys the speed limit and signals all her turns. But Sheriff Curran points out there are plenty of unlicensed drivers who don't.
And that's not good for public safety. I mean, we want people to have taken a driver's test. We want people to have insurance. We want people to understand the rules of the road.
It would be irresponsible and reckless for our office to roll out a program of this magnitude statewide without first thoroughly testing it.
Henry Haupt is a spokesman for the Secretary of State. He says his office has needed all 10 months since Governor Pat Quinn signed the measure into law. Haupt says by February, the Secretary of State will be setting licensing appointments at 36 facilities statewide.
Keep in mind that the state of California has been given approximately 2 years to implement their program. And we've had to set all this up without any additional revenue provided by the General Assembly. To just open up facilities throughout the state without testing it and potentially have thousands upon thousands of individuals show up at facilities wouldn't do anyone any good.
I found at least one Chicago area sheriff who doesn't mind the Secretary of State's pace if it helps avoid mistakes. But that approach will keep many immigrant drivers unlicensed for months to come. Lopez says after 23 years in the United States, she deserves a license. And for her peace of mind, she says, she needs one sooner rather than later. I'm Chip Mitchell in Chicago.
Hi, I'm David Inge, host of Illinois Pioneers on WILL-TV. This Thursday, I'm joined by Steve Burgess, the son of James Burgess Jr., former state's attorney of Champaign County, and to date, the only African-American elected to that office. He shares stories from his father's life, including his role as a member of the 761st Tank Battalion, the first African-American armored unit to enter World War II. Join me for Illinois Pioneers tonight at 7:30 on WILL-TV.
You're listening to Morning Edition on WILL. I'm Jeff Bossert. It's 8:41. The tornado damage in Gifford reminds Jim Gilliland of the tornado that heavily damaged the Champaign County town of Ogden in April of 1996. Gilliland was mayor of Ogden at the time. While his own home was spared, he remembers walking in downtown Ogden, smelling gas and seeing devastation all around him.
I just didn't know what to do. I just stood there and looked every direction I looked in. There was destruction, and I thought, what am I going to do? This is beyond me.
But Gilliland says the people of Ogden rallied with help from state and federal agencies and were able to rebuild their community over the next few years. Speaking on yesterday morning's Focus program on AM 580, Gilliland said Ogden's recovery is proof of how a small town can come back from a tornado's destruction.
I can't say enough about the people of Ogden, the resiliency that they showed, and I would encourage the people of Gifford to stand firm, and they will get through this.
The current mayor of Ogden, Jack Reidner, also called in during Focus with words of encouragement for the people of Gifford. Not even the EF4 tornado that ripped through their town. No opponent this year has managed to stop the undefeated Washington, Illinois high school football team. Not even the tornado that ripped through their town last weekend. As the school gets ready for this weekend's playoff game, coaches and players see the team has become a rallying point for the community. Illinois Public Radio's Charlie Schlenker has this report.
The Washington Panthers are practicing at Illinois State University's Hancock Stadium in Normal, getting ready for Saturday's Class 5A semifinal game in Springfield against Sacred Heart Griffin. At least nine of the team lost their homes in Sunday's tornado.
He came over and said, you know, you have an appliance on top of you. I didn't think I was going to get out of there for quite some time.
Jake Clark is a running back. He was asleep in his basement room and woke up to loud winds. His father yelled at him to come upstairs and look. Dad was videotaping the twister and its huge dark debris cloud because he didn't think it would come for them. Not so.
And I yelled at him, we got to get downstairs, and grabbed him by his shirt and pulled him downstairs with me. And 2 seconds we were in the basement and everything just exploded. And so I just took cover behind my couch to get out of the way of the windows and stuff and put my hands over my head. And I felt stuff starting to fall on top of me, and my dad had to come dig me out. And there's another person's oven on top of me, and along with roof trusses and all that stuff, so it wasn't good.
Jake isn't dressed to practice. He has scratches on his face and arms and a nail hole and bruises in his back. He says he can't run right now because of the debris that fell on him.
And then we got up and got outside trying to help people. All you could hear was, you know, kids screaming for help. It was really scary, and we just got out there to help as soon as we could.
By some odd chance, everyone on Clark's block was okay. Clark says he looked at the wreckage and had a bad moment considering homelessness. He and his family have been going back to the rubble every day to look for belongings.
We found quite a bit of stuff. I made out the best out of my whole family, probably because my room was in the basement, so I was actually able to get most of my clothes and and belongings and stuff, and guitars and stuff like that. But my dad and little sister, their rooms were upstairs, so their stuff is pretty much all gone.
Everyone on the team knows someone who's trying to dig out from the mounds of debris that used to be 1,000 homes in the Tazewell County town. Wide receiver Hayden Bodine is one of the fortunate ones. Bodine says after the all-clear, he and his dad hopped in the truck without shirt or shoes to drive around, not expecting to see much.
Brand new houses just destroyed, and we saw people coming outside screaming. And we just went into action and just started helping. Kid on a football team, I went to his house, and he just got a concussion, so I kind of grabbed him, put him inside, and laid him down. He had no idea what was going on. His head was pounding, he said. He just had no idea.
Hayden says he and his father drove home, packed water and clothing into their truck, and started distributing it that day.
I don't know what I was thinking about. It's just really adrenaline, just doing whatever I could. I had no idea what was going on. Just breaks your heart.
The team met Monday in their locker room and went out and walked, collecting goods strewn around. They found an iPad, a laptop, both worked, and other things, even one of their own team members' helmets. Two offensive linemen lost everything, including their jerseys and game pants. Bodine says the team scrounged extra. He says there are mixed emotions. You feel bad for the players and proud they're responding well.
When they're at football, it's like a whole different setting, and they're not thinking about it. And we know after football, they're going to be a little devastated again. But that's what we're here for. We're teammates. We're going to pick them up. We're going to help this community.
So is football a refuge then?
I would say so. It just gets them away from everything.
How do you work your way into getting ready mentally for the game when you have these other things going on?
It's tough. You just kind of isolate yourself and just be thankful everything's okay. And our coach has done a great job keeping us together as one and just trying to be leaders. That's all we got, all we really can do.
Casey Danley is number 21. He's a running back.
I was with some of the players and one of my coaches. We all go to church every Sunday.
The twister came right through Danley's neighborhood.
It was crazy because we went into the locker room and we heard the tornado go right by us, and we could feel the locker room shaking and everything. It was real scary. Never experienced anything like it. I don't wish it upon anyone else.
Even with a catastrophe like this, Clark, Danley, and Bodine want to win the next game. Washington is 12-0, undefeated for the first time this late in the season. Running back Jake Clark says the team is pulling together.
I was still shaken from everything that happened, and I saw kids from the team in the backs of trucks getting bussed over to the bad spots to help people out. And then yesterday I was digging stuff out of my house and Coach Crouch came up with 20 other football players, and it was just great to see.
Clark says he can't even count the number of friends who've offered places to stay. Because of that, Clark says he's not worried about anything right now. While the school is closed because of the lack of potable water, power, and curfew restrictions in Washington, the football team practices at Illinois State University. Washington's defeated quarterfinal playoff opponent, University High School in Normal, is providing hot lunches and other help. Hayden Bodine seems overwhelmed.
That's awesome. For them, it's just, you're just so grateful for people like that and communities like that just to respond to us and give us things that we need. It's just amazing. You give your heart out to them.
The Panthers' next opponent, Sacred Heart Griffin, is likewise offering meals and some buses to get Washington fans to the weekend game because many lost their vehicles in the twister. Casey Danley says going forward with the game will help the town of Washington as well as the players.
It's one town, one community, one team. And so we're coming together as a community even more than we have through this football team. And we're just trying to go out there and get a win on Saturday for the town and our team.
I'm Charlie Schlenker.
And the Illinois High School Association yesterday announced that the semifinal between Washington and Sacred Heart Griffin will be shown on Comcast Sportsnet Chicago, Springfield's WCIX, and WAOE and WYZZ in Peoria. The IHSA is also streaming the playoff game online at IHSA.tv. It's Morning Edition on WILL. I'm Jeff Bossert. Occasional rain today, a high around 50 degrees. Right now, 47 degrees in Danville and Decatur, 47 on Friends Plaza.
From NPR member stations and from Esurance, insurance for the modern world, offering online and mobile car insurance tools to guide customers from quote to claim, esurance.com. From the MD Anderson Cancer Center, whose research strives to set standards for cancer care, Learn more at makingcancerhistory.com. And from Road Scholar, with educational travel adventures to 150 countries, including Cuba this winter, at roadscholar.org. This is NPR.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. For over 96 years, generations of farmers have turned to Farm Credit for their financial needs. Whether a young farmer or a seasoned grower, Farm Credit offers products and service geared specifically to the agricultural community.
Good Thursday morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with the opening Commodity Market Report. Talks ramped up on the farm bill yesterday after House Speaker John Boehner told Republicans he was setting a hard deadline to adjourn the House on December 13th. House Agriculture Committee Chairman Frank Lucas, House Agriculture Ranking Member Colin Peterson, Senate Agriculture Committee Chairman Debbie Stabenow, and Senate Agriculture Ranking Member Thad Cochran met Wednesday evening for 90 minutes and said that they had made some progress and said they are meeting again today. This morning, USDA released its latest export sales report for the week ending November the 14th. Here's how the numbers look in millions of bushels. Wheat this year, 22.7. Corn this year, 37.2, and next year 1.5, and soybeans this year 50.6. China custom officials today say that PRC imports of corn for October totaled about 39,000 tons. That's down 91.3% from a year ago. Soybean imports for October amounted to 4.19 million tons. That's 3.9% higher than last year. This morning, Japan announced that it has purchased almost 134,000 metric tons of milling wheat in five grades, including three grades of U.S. wheat, totaling just over 51,000 tons. That was the first wheat purchase for Japan in 3 weeks. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is 15,923. It's up 45 points. The NASDAQ, 3,383, up 17. The S&P 500, 1,784, up 4.75 points. Joining us now with a look at agricultural weather is meteorologist Drew Lerner.
Weather conditions across the Midwest are expected to deteriorate somewhat over the next couple of days, and late-season farming activity will likely be put on hold for a little while as we wait for a big surge of cold air to overrun the majority of the region. The arrival of the cold is going to be condensing moisture out of the atmosphere in many areas. Most locations in the central and lower parts of the Midwest will see rain and some thunderstorm activity over the next couple of days, while in the northwestern portions of the Midwest will likely see snowfall. The snow is not expected to be quite as heavy as advertised yesterday, but there will still be enough out there to maybe lay down a little layer of protection for some of the winter wheat crop in the northern plains and the northwestern portions of the Midwest. But for the most part, the snow is going to be only a minor influence on travel across the region. We'll expect the snowfall rates to run mostly a dusting upwards to 2 inches, but there will be a few locations that could still see something in the 2 to 4 inch range. The precipitation will be most common from Nebraska and portions of northeastern Colorado across northern Kansas into Wisconsin. And a lot of this will occur as we go through the night tonight and into the morning tomorrow. In the meantime, a few showers and thunderstorms have already erupted this morning in portions of Missouri and Iowa and eastern Kansas, and we'll likely see this little disturbance moving to the Great Lakes region, and we'll likely see moisture totals vary, but mostly be on the light side, running a few hundredths of an inch upwards to maybe 3 or 4 tenths of an inch, with a few exceptions. A more generalized precipitation event will occur when the cold front cuts through the Midwest here tomorrow into Friday morning, and we'll likely see another 2/10 to 3/4 inch of rain, with some local totals maybe going over an inch, especially in the lower portions of the Midwest from parts of the northern Delta and southeastern Missouri into Indiana. There will be a risk of some severe thunderstorms again with this particular setup, but it probably won't be nearly what it was this past weekend. We'll expect to see drier air move across most of the Midwest as we get into the Friday-Saturday time period, but temperatures will turn bitterly cold. Most of the afternoon temperatures will fall into the teens and 20s across a big part of the northern Midwest and 20s and 30s in the south during the colder days. But it will be relatively short-lived. Our low temperatures at night will fall below zero in the northern plains and in the positive negative single digits perhaps in the far northwestern Corn Belt. We'll expect to see a little short-term warm-up, but a reinforcing shot of cool air will come in early next week that will likely generate some more cold weather for the northern parts of the Midwest. And what's interesting most is that a low-pressure center may develop in the Delta or the southeastern plains as we get into the end of this week or early in the weekend, and it could turn out to be a little nor'easter for portions of the middle and north Atlantic coastal areas as we get into the early to middle part of next week. That storm system will be closely monitored for travel issues, obviously. The temperatures will begin to warm up across parts of the Midwest as we get into the middle part of next week, and a little bit more normal weather will occur. We'll see an increase in precipitation possible back across the region as well. But as far as precipitation is concerned for the period from Friday into Sunday, maybe even Monday, the only precipitation will occur as lake effect snows in western Michigan, northwestern Indiana, and northeastern Ohio. This is meteorologist Drew Lerner.
Support for today's broadcast comes from ADM. Their FarmerView mobile site features up-to-date futures, weather, market commentary, and local bids, and offers ADM customers access to contracts, deliveries, and payments. Available at adm.com/farmerview.
Well, let's see how futures are currently trading. Hard red December wheat is $6.99, up 3.5. Soft December is $6.48¾, up 1.5. December corn's trading $4.20¼, up 3¼. July $4.22½, up 2¼. January soybeans $12.81, up 7¼. July $12.55¼, now $12.55¾, up 5½. December soybean meal $4.06.50, down 50. December soybean oil $41.05, up 73. December live cattle $130.95, down 10. November feeders $164.80, up 22½. And December lean hogs are $86.17½, and they're down 7½. Joining us on the telephone to talk about the markets is Ellen Dearden of Ag Review, and she is in Moreton, Illinois. Good morning, Ellen.
Good morning to you, Dave.
That soybean market has a little giddy up in it this morning.
Yeah, the bean side is looking a little better, and the bull spreads are working. We've seen a big upside move in the palm oil this week. We're now back to highest levels since last February, and that bodes well because it's been bean oil that's not had a lot of giddy up on the complex lately, and this morning it's meal that's not able to really get going.
Yeah, I suppose on the next Wisely report, we might see an adjustment for the soybean export number?
I would sure expect so. We're up, bookings are up at around 90% of the total export projection from USDA. So another week when we've got 51 million bushels of beans booked looks pretty darn encouraging. We're up to, what, 1.3 billion? Bushel at this stage of the game, pretty early in the crop year to be that far along.
Meanwhile, in corn, the tire continues to leak very slowly.
Yeah, corn market just has been difficult to get going. I noticed on the export bookings this morning that Japan took about a third of that, a little bit more than a third, and China took about a third of the 37 million bushels that were listed for export. And China's showing their, on the October figures anyway, their imported corn was down considerably from a year ago at only 39 million metric tons.
I suppose the last feature for this week, before we move into that short week next week, and well, that might be dull, we do have option expiration on Friday.
Option expiration and the brunt of the puts and the calls on these December corn anyway are between $4 and $4.20. Earlier in the week, they were all centered at $4, and some of those have been liquidated. So it will be kind of interesting to see how that shakes out. The options are not as heavily invested in the wheat, however, but also in the meal and the bean oil.
We'll turn our attention to livestock, please.
Livestock market's kind of been a mixed bag. We're seeing carcass values weak on the hog side, but we saw a late rally yesterday and closed right on the high. We'll see higher hog futures on follow-through, but probably not on the live cattle side. That looks a little bit mixed. I thought we're set up for some cash business here today. That comes in better, we could be setting up for a late week rally in the cattle into the cattle on feed report Friday.
Do you think that retail pork bargain hunters might see something post Thanksgiving but before Christmas?
I would certainly think so.